years ago, some of you undoubtedly remember, I don't think we're all too old to remember some of the, at least some of this. I know some of you were involved in this. Steve Fales put together a symposium at the meetings in Anaheim entitled 40 Years of Forage Quality Research. And I gave a talk at that, helped by Ken Vogel. And one of the things we did is we wrote a paper, Accomplishments and Impact from Breeding for Improved Forage Quality, published in Crop Science. And you might be interested to know that that paper is actually number 19 on the list of most frequently cited articles in Crop Science, and at least as far as I understand, in the history of Crop Science. So I'm actually pretty pleased about that. I mean, that we've got a review article on forages in the top 19 of Crop Science. I think that's a pretty good accomplishment for Division C6. Okay, so today I'm going to talk a little bit of history, give a few examples, not very many. Talk a little bit about why does this work, why can we breed for improved forage quality, what problems have we solved, what challenges do we still face, and just finish up a little bit with future prospects. I'm not going to go very deep into this topic because there's a ton of literature out there. I'm just going to try to hit some of the highlights and talk a little bit about that. So I'm glad that Joe set the stage here because I view this as a historical process as well. So it's early days. Imagine yourself in the late 1950s. There's lots of excitement over new laboratory methods to measure some chemical, some nutritional characteristics of forages and feeds. The methodology is still fairly crude, but nevertheless, we're still very excited about it. Most of the variables can't, at this point, strictly be defined in terms of fundamental plant constituents. But one of the interesting things is there's still a lot of naysayers. There's a lot of people out there, and if you really dig deeply into the literature, it's not all published literature, but if you dig into reports of committees and various types of things, you'll see a lot of naysayers, a lot of people that are saying, oh, this is absolutely no good for forages. It's not going to work because plants are going to lodge. These plants will be robbed of vigor and ability to produce seed, and they're going to be more susceptible to disease and insects. So, you know, if you believe all of this, you say, well, okay, forget about this. We plant breeders have other problems we can solve, okay? All right, so first of all, I got to give a little disclaimer here. Monty said when he started off the session that we have some great speakers with one exception. I must be the exception because I'm the plant breeder that's software challenged, okay? So I apologize. I tell my students never apologize for your slides, but I'm going to have to do it today. Because all my graphs, they don't have any borders, okay? So please bear with me. All right, so Bermuda grass, okay? The first cultivar ever released with documented improvement in forage quality as a result of breeding, okay? Not happenstance, but actually as a result of the breeder making conscious decisions, was Tifton 44. And Gary Hill, in a nice study that he did back in the late 80s and early 90s, documented this very well. But what you want to look at here, this is coastal right here at 100% forage yield and IVDMD. I've just standardized everything to 100, okay? And you look across here and you see Tifton 44 has about a 2% increase in digestibility, okay? And about a 3% reduction in forage yield, okay? So even though that 2% increase in digestibility is backed up by a documented increase in livestock performance, most of you know the program at Tifton, and that's what they did. That was one of the big reasons for their success. You still have a 3% reduction in yield. In other words, the naysayers are right, aren't they? Okay? All right, so just picture that, all right? And then we go to the next cultivar, Tifton 68, okay? You see a huge increase in digestibility, but yield went down again. So now, instead of a 3% reduction in yield, we've got a 5% reduction in forage yield. Nevertheless, the breeder said, we're going to go ahead with this. We've got documented increase in livestock performance, and we're going to go ahead and proceed. The cultivar was released, and you all know, most of you know the story. You know that these cultivars have been widely successful, not only in the southeastern United States, but other parts of the world. Okay? So even though these cultivars are successful, they're being adopted, as late as 1993, we still had naysayers. Three plant breeders, three very, very well-respected and very successful plant breeders. These weren't people that just fell off a potato truck, Okay, these are very successful plant breeders. They said the role of plant improvement by breeding in such systems is highly questionable. The progress we've witnessed in breeding for improved nutritive value largely consists of chance findings, I love this, as well as early maturity selections from within a population. Did you breeders know that's what you were doing? Selecting for earliness? Once the gross variation due to maturity classes have been taken care of by maturity grouping, there's little net variation left to be measured accurately within these maturity groups. Okay, so let's finish this off with Bermuda grass. All right, again, most of you know the story. You know that by the time we got farther down the road here, this group here, Tifton 78 has an increase in digestibility and an increase in yield. Tifton 85, what? You people from the South, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is it's one of the most successful Bermuda grass varieties of all time. And obviously you can see what's going on here. Huge increase in yield and a huge increase in digestibility. So clearly, the trends that were observed early on with the first couple of cultivars, they weren't real. They were just circumstantial. It needed time, needed a lot of effort. The breeder needed to select for increased digestibility and increased yield at the same time. But clearly those two traits are not physiologically negatively correlated. Okay? All right, so I've avoided mentioning the name of this breeder so far, but I think you all know who I'm talking about. Was Glenn Burton smart or was he lucky? Okay, in my opinion, clearly he was both. He had a vision, he persisted in pursuing that vision despite many distractions and many, many detractors. And many of you know he was amazingly innovative, persistent, and intuitive. But you also got to realize that he entered the right situation at the right time with the right group of colleagues and just the right collection of expertise among those colleagues to make it work. It probably wouldn't have worked in a lot of other situations. Okay. So let's come back, now that I've kind of set the stage, let's come back to some of the things that have contributed to the progress made in the Bermuda grass program as well as many others. And if you're disappointed today that I'm not going to do a lot of other history and talk about a lot of other examples, I simply refer you to that paper in Crop Science and other papers that some of us have written, because there are a lot of examples. I'm just going to try to hit some of the highlights today. So, breeding progress obviously requires genotypic variation for a measurable plant trait, and I'm talking about a plant trait, okay? Something that actually is a component of that plant or can be measured on the plant. We need appropriate sampling methodology, so we need to think in terms of what's the appropriate growth stage and the plant part, sampling times and sampling dates. How do all these fit into the scheme that we're trying to focus on in breeding for increased quality? Replication, interestingly enough, a lot of people feel that we need to be replicating these plants, but we don't. For most traits, or at least a lot of variables that we measure, we can actually, as plant breeders, go out there on unreplicated plants, select the best plants, and it's actually quite a repeatable process. That's one of the amazing things that's allowed us to make progress. Appropriate laboratory methodology. And this is extremely critical. We need something that has a very small sample size. It needs to be highly repeatable. It needs to be very high throughput. In other words, what I mean by throughput is you need to get through the process fairly rapidly, and you need to be able to process many samples fairly rapidly. And of course, this isn't necessary for breeding progress, but it's necessary to be able to, you know, to have something relevant, and that is that it has to be relevance to the nutritional parameter of interest. Obviously, if we're going to spend some time breeding for increased forage quality, we need to select the right trait. Okay, again, I thank you, Joe, for sort of setting the stage for me. In my opinion, the two most important advancements in allowing others of us, and many of us throughout the world, to make advancement in this area are teleinterferon and near-infrared reflectance. Okay, now this is the audience participation part of this talk, all right? We all know that Tilley and Terry developed the first in vitro dry matter digestibility method in 1963, and the hallmarks of that are small sample size, high throughput, with hundreds of samples. But the question is, who inspired Tilley and Terry to do this? Does anybody know? I got one answer up here. Anybody else? Anybody else? My understanding is it was J.P. Cooper, who was their colleague at the Welsh Plant Breeding Station, and J.P. Cooper was, anybody? The grass breeder. The grass breeder came to Tilly and Terry and said, look, I got a problem. I want to work on this stuff that's new and exciting right now. I'm not one of the naysayers. So Tilly and Terry developed this technique specifically so that they could handle large numbers of samples and relatively small sample size in the plant breeding program. Okay, and then of course the other advancement, which has already been mentioned this morning, and I can't give enough kudos to John Schenck for all the work that he's done, but I got to tell you, I was kind of disappointed in John in the early days. And why was that? What was John's earlier job before he became the big NIR guru? Anybody remember? He was a grass breeder. And so here we are. We all bemoan the fact that we're losing grass breeders all the time, and we lost one right there. But I have to say, that was a good loss, okay? Not because he was a bad grass breeder, but obviously because he's left a greater legacy. Okay. All right. And obviously, what NIR allows us to do is much higher throughput. We can go from hundreds of samples to thousands of samples now. So we're talking about an order of magnitude greater in terms of processing samples. And you've all heard, plant breeding is a numbers game. And that is an absolute truth to plant breeding. It's a numbers game. The more numbers we can process, the greater the gain that we're going to be able to make. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about why we've been able to make some of this progress. So just in terms of increasing digestibility, the cell consists of about 50 to 80% carbohydrates, depending on species and stage of maturity. These carbohydrates, some of them are highly indigestible, cellulose, hemicellulose, pectins. Some of them are non-structural, and most of those are highly digestible, sugars, fructans, and starch. Okay. So what mechanisms do we have for increasing digestibility? We can increase non-structural carbohydrates in the cell, and we can decrease structural carbohydrates. In other words, we can reduce the amount of cell wall material and we can increase the cell contents. You've already heard discussions about cell solubles and all that sort of thing. We know the reasons for doing this, and this is one mechanism for increasing digestibility. You've seen Dave's equations that relate digestibility to NDF. Okay. The other thing we can do, and this is a little bit more theoretical, it hasn't actually been proven yet, but I suspect that this is probably the case, we can increase total photosynthesis and partitioning to soluble carbohydrates. And I think, again, the data isn't there, the experiments haven't been done, but I think this is probably the explanation behind the high sugar grasses. These are mostly rye grasses that have been developed in Europe and Australia. And I think that's probably the explanation for what's going on there. Okay. Change gears a little bit. We've talked about a little bit about dry matter digestibility, but then there's also the issue of digestibility of the cell wall per se. Obviously, the cell wall is very recalcitrant with respect to digestion. There's a lot of nutrients in the cell wall, but it's very difficult for the microbes to get at them. And one of the main reasons for that is the lignin that's in the cell wall. Lignin is sort of like a glue or caulking compound that fills in many of the empty spaces. You see here a model of the primary cell wall that has all the major components. We'll just take that picture and just imagine that you just fired a caulking gun right into there with caulk and just filled up all those empty spaces with something called lignin that is completely and utterly indigestible. Okay? That's essentially what lignin does. Okay, so how can we attack this problem? All right? So if you kind of break that down into its fundamental components, you have a xylan chain or a backbone of what we call hemicellulose. And on this backbone, you have side units, side chains that are formed by arabinose side units. And then on those arabinose side units, you have two ferulates that are attached to those. One is attached ester-linked, and the other is an ether-linked ferulate. And once you have those two ferulates attached to the arabinose side unit, then lignin builds on top of that. And that's how lignin is actually chemically bonded to cell wall components. Okay? So from this, we can see we have two distinct mechanisms to be able to increase digestibility that are related to lignin. One is we can reduce the amount of lignin per se. The other is we can try to cut off some of those side chains and eliminate some of the possibilities for lignin to form chemical bonds with carbohydrates. Okay, so this is some data of Ken Vogel's And Ken, you don't recognize this because this is hybrid data from two different papers that, that you've published. You know, we statisticians can get away with anything. So, but essentially, over a number of cycles of selection in switchgrass, Ken has been selecting for increased digestibility and tracking with digestibility along that entire process of selecting has been a consistent and measurable response in lignin concentration. And that regression relationship is for a one unit change in lignin results in an opposite change of digestibility of 6.4 units. And what's really remarkable about this is, as you can see, it's been consistent over many cycles of selection. It's also consistent from one species to the next. We've done this in a number of different cool season grasses as well, and we consistently come up with the same magnitude of relationship. About a one unit change in lignin causes about a 7-unit change in digestibility. So it seems to be fairly consistent, at least in the grasses. And if you take that even further, you can look at the anatomy of these high lignin and low lignin switchgrasses, and it's really quite easy to see some of the fundamental differences in stem structure as a result of that. On the left, you have a high lignin stem, 6.3%. On the right, you have a low lignin stem. Comparable difference in digestibility, also a comparable difference in ethanol yield in an ethanol fermentation system. Okay? All right. So that's lignin concentration. Let's come back to our model for lignin carbohydrate cross-linking, and let's take a look now at the other potential mechanism, and that is the ether and ester-linked ferulates. So one of the things we've been doing in the cool season grasses, and there are three different grasses represented by the three different colors or the three different shaped symbols on this graph. One of the things we've been doing is we've been trying to conduct selection for lignin concentration, but also to select plants that have a lower frequency of these side chains and these ferulate crosslinks between xylan and lignin. And so we take a distribution like this, like you see the one with the two arrows, and essentially what we're doing is we're selecting plants vertically that differ in ferulate crosslinking, and are consistent in lignin concentration, and then horizontally, that horizontal arrow shows plants that are different in lignin concentration with very similar cross-linking. Okay? So there's a level of independence between these two traits that allows us to be able to do that. And once we do that, these are averages over all three species. I've just kind of pooled the data together just so that it's actually presentable. You can see on the top we have high lignin plants and low lignin plants. They differ in lignin, 154, 148 grams per kilogram. There's no difference in etherified ferulates in the middle column. And you can see a very significant difference in 96-hour NDF digestibility. Okay? You go to the bottom, and you have high etherified ferulate plants, in other words, plants that have a high frequency of etherified ferulate bonding, and low etherified ferulate plants. They do not differ in lignin concentration. You see the first column. You go to the middle column, and they differ in etherified ferulates, just what they were selected for. And you also see a difference in digestibility, as we would predict. So what we've done is we've discovered there are two independent mechanisms for increasing cell wall digestibility. We can reduce the amount of lignin per se, but we can also reduce cross-linking, and they work independently of each other. Okay? Is there a synergistic effect? I don't know. We haven't done the experiments yet. We haven't even gotten that far in terms of selection. It's an interesting thought, something that we'll try to figure out down the road. Okay, agronomic consequences. Come back to the naysayers. Some of the things that have been talked about with digestibility is lodging. So far, there's absolutely no reported problem with lodging of high digestibility materials. And in fact, the only papers that have been published, the best papers that have been published, where the plants have really been challenged to lodge under conditions that promote lodging, it was actually the low lignin plants, the low lignin genotypes, that had the most lodging resistance. And the hypothesis there was that low lignin plants had more flexibility in the stems, allowing the stems to bend under wind and other circumstances without breaking. So that's kind of an interesting result. Forage and seed yield, no direct relationships. Diseases, We've seen some relationships, but none of them are lasting. Once the breeder goes back into the population and starts intensively selecting for disease resistance, it's always been restored so far. Insect resistant, yes, there are some issues with stem borers. I'm not going to go into details on that. I've done that in some of my other talks and other papers, but there are some examples there. That can be an issue. And then stresses. We're just getting some very recent data out of Ken Vogel's program with the switchgrass that low lignin may lead to collapsed xylem vessels, which would reduce the potential for water intake. Obviously, this is a very serious situation that needs to be very carefully studied. And then the last one I want to mention is intake. We've had a lot of discussion about intake this morning, and there has been some attention focused on breeding for increased intake, most of it through by measuring fiber. And one of the things we've learned unequivocally is decreasing NDF decreases forage yield. Okay? And here's an example of that. This is four different populations of smooth brome grass, four different varieties, in which we selected for high versus low NDF. So if you look across the bottom of that, each of those individual graphs has a minus one, a zero, and a one. Zero is the original population. Minus one is the selection for low lignin. Plus one is the selection for high lignin. Okay? And in those four graphs, what we're measuring is forage yield. So we're measuring forage yield as a response to selecting for divergent NDF. And you can see in every case, there's a positive relationship. In Lincoln, it wasn't quite significant. But doing a genetic analysis of this and assigning variation to the various genetic factors that can cause two variables to be correlated with each other, in this case, forage yield and NDF, we found that 72% of the variation was due to genes with common effects for which there's no plant breeding solution. In other words, some genes affect yield and NDF together. And in fact, a few years ago, Ken got up after I gave a talk on some of this data and he says, well, they're the same trait. And yeah, they're pretty close to the same trait. Okay? 3% of the variation could be attributed to differential chromosome linkage patterns. That's something that we can solve as plant breeders, but it's only 3%, so it's nothing to get excited about. 25% of the variation in these four graphs here were due to random changes, which are a result of finite population sizes. And this is something that could be fixed with hybrids. Okay, so keep that in mind. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute before I quit. But what I'm going to address is the no solution part of this first. And there actually is a solution, and that is to come up with a different trait. Okay, and I'm really glad you led into me here, Joe, this morning, because we have come up with a different trait that we are fairly excited about. This PSRI is called Particle Size Reduction Index. Essentially, it's a ball milling technique that I developed a number of years ago to try to get at a mechanism to test different forages for their ability to be broken down into a smaller particle size. And what we see is that, so keep in mind, high values are good and low values are bad. Okay, so we want to select for high values of this particular characteristic. So about half the variation here in forage yield is due to genes with common effects. Okay, so there's some genes that regulate both of these traits in a direction that's not very favorable to us. But also about half the variability is under our control. Some of it we can fix by altering the linkage patterns of the genes that are controlling the two traits. Some of it is due to random changes due to finite population size. Okay, so we're kind of excited about that as an alternative to selecting for low NDF. So let me come back to this hybrid issue before I quit. So how do we recover losses in forage yield after we've been selecting for, say, low end, this, in this case, it's low NDF. It could be any other trait, okay? So the idea is we conduct parallel selection in diverse populations, and that's what the two lines going down show. We're selecting within the A population and the B population. When we get down to our selected populations, then we strain cross them together and make a hybrid. And the idea is that if there's any hybrid vigor in the species we're working on, then we ought to be able to restore some of that forage yield that we lost as a result of finite population sizes during selection. And this is actually the first data. This data isn't even published yet. This is the first data we have on whether or not this is possible. And if you look, I have six hybrids over here that I've made among those four original populations. These are hybrids between our low NDF populations. Here we have the parents in this first column. This is forage yield. And here we have the hybrids in the second column, also forage yield. You can see for four of the six hybrids, we have significant heterosis okay? Heterosis being that the hybrid here is higher than the mean of the parents, okay? So for four of those, in two of those, it didn't work because NDF went up here. You can see for this one right here and also for this one down at the bottom, NDF went up, okay? So it sort of defeated the whole purpose. But for two of those, it actually looks like it worked. We got heterosis for yield, a boost in yield, an increase in yield, and no change in the original selection characteristic NDF. Okay, so maybe it's possible. Now, I haven't even touched the issue of how do we do this commercially, but you know, from a scientific standpoint, it looks like it's sort of a validation of what we saw previously, our statistical models that allowed us to assign genetic causes to these correlations that we're seeing. So there's some potential there. Okay, to finish up, after 50 plus years of activity, we're beginning to see trends for agronomic consequences. Selection outside field-based environments almost always leads to problems. Loss of yield, reduced stress tolerances, lots of other things. Quick fixes, such as single genes or transgenes with huge effects on forage quality, nearly always have huge effects on plant morphology, structure, function, and vigor. Quality traits with huge roles in plant functionality may not be good targets for improving forage quality. And I'm specifically thinking about NDF there. Okay, and then to finish up, a large number of fundamental plant traits, including anatomical structure, cell wall structure, composition, are amenable to genetic manipulation. The limits to selection progress are still well beyond our near-term capabilities. Numerous cultivars with documented increases in forage quality and livestock performance have been released and are in market channels. So we know this process works in general, okay? And gains will certainly continue for many years. And as many of you know, you never get to a place like this without a lot of help from a lot of other people. So this is my little tribute to a little help from me, friends. Thank you. Thank you.